I'm very happy to welcome Sarah Jaffe to our show. Sarah Jaffe's a staff writer at In These Times and a fellow at the Nation Institute. She covers labor, social movements, gender, and media issues for The Atlantic, The Nation, The American Prospect, Alternate, and many other publications. Sarah, it's great to have you on the show tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So one of the things you've been covering for years now, and it certainly came to the fore this past week, and that was the movement to raise low-wage workers' salaries. And we had more than 220 cities across the U.S. Being the sites of protests, marches, walking off the job in an effort to push for a $15 an hour minimum wage. And the right to join labor unions was certainly another feature of these actions. I wonder if you would just give us your overview, having looked at this low-wage workers movement that really first came on the scene and came to public attention in November 2012. What is the meaning of this particular day of action, which was said to be one of the largest protests of low-wage workers in U.S. history?
Yeah, so what we've seen since that 2012 first series of strikes in New York City is the movement has expanded to different cities, has then started having these big days of action, which are coordinated across many cities, at this point even across many countries, where you have some workers going on strike, you have others coming out to support them, you have big protest rallies, marches, civil disobedience of all kinds at this point. And these have really grown from being workers in the fast food sector to they spread to retail, they spread to they've started including like home health care aides, child care workers. There's pretty much you name it. Adjunct professors made a prominent appearance at this past week's events, calling for $15,000 a class. And so we've really seen something that started as a very particular campaign and a very particular set of workplaces really grow into a broad demand for workers that say $15 an hour sounds like a pretty good wage floor that would do a lot to change the conditions for a lot of workers. And a recent study actually found that workers who make under $15 an hour are actually 42% of the American workforce. So we're talking about a huge chunk of people who would benefit if we actually raised the wage this much.
So we've seen some response by some major corporations like McDonald's and Walmart that have come out quite recently in announcing wage hikes for some of their lowest paid workers. And it's hard not to connect the dots between this new workers movement and some of what I guess the PR officials at these companies feeling that they really have to come out on a better side of this protest movement. What can you say substantively about these announcements by McDonald's and Walmart talking about that they are going to be hiking wages at least a bit, certainly not up to the standard of demands that are made by workers in the street?
Yeah, exactly. They're certainly not going to bring them up to the demands made by workers for one reason, because then they'd have to admit that they were responding to demands made by workers. Because at this point, when you see these press announcements go out, they almost never acknowledge that these raises are being given because you have hundreds and thousands of your workers in the streets protesting and calling for it. So yeah, it's very interesting to see. It's a good start. It's not enough, as most of the workers said. It's not even close to enough. And we should not forget that these gestures in the right direction from these employers also come along with some much more negative, the stick of the carrot and the stick, right? Walmart just announced this week with a few hours' notice that it would be closing several stores for some mysterious plumbing issues. Notably, one of those stores is the Pico Rivera, California store, which was the site of the first strikes at Walmart also in the fall of 2012. It was the most recent site of sit-down strikes, the first time Walmart workers had held sit-down strikes this past fall. And it has suddenly been closed. All of the workers who work there were told that they have to reapply for their jobs when it is reopened in 6 months after they fix these, quote, plumbing problems. And no city official had heard anything about plumbing problems that would require the store to be closed for 6 months. So the workers have filed a complaint that this is obvious retaliation. Walmart has done things like this before. It has closed stores. It famously eliminated all of the meat cutters from its grocery stores after a small group of meat cutters managed to win a union election back in the early 2000s in Texas. So it's hard not to see that as also connected, particularly when it's the most prominent Walmart store that has seen strikes.
I want to get to unionization drives that are certainly part of this movement in a moment, but I also wanted to touch on some of the other victories that this movement may be able to claim. Since the protests erupted in November 2012, we've had just quite recently a spate of statewide referendums on raising the minimum wage, and they've had some victories there, and I'm wondering if you can directly attribute those referendum questions and their victories to this new workers movement.
I mean, I think it's really hard to not connect the dots here. We're looking at a massive workers movement that's directly calling for a specific wage floor. We were also looking at the rise of Occupy Wall Street, which really put inequality on the agenda. We're looking at a lot of different movements that have been percolating over the past few years that really call attention to the fact that there's a whole lot of people in this country who are getting, you know, not to put it too bluntly, screwed on a daily basis. And so you have all of that pressure coming out in places like Arkansas and Nebraska, where most people would kind of write off a campaign for workers' rights in general. And yet, these measures passed. I think the least popular one passed with 60% of the vote. And these are places, these came notably as Democrats were losing in the same states. But so we've definitely seen the ballot initiative as a useful tactic for this movement. We've also seen some of these victories come through legislatures. So Seattle, which was the first major city to go to $15 an hour, it was passed through the city council.
Right. No, the Kashama Sawant and the Socialist Alternative and the role they played in some street heat there was very important. And we can talk a little bit about that before we say goodnight. We're speaking with Sarah Jaffe this evening here on Counterpoint. She's a staff writer at In These Times and a fellow at the Nation Institute, covering a host of issues, including labor and social movements and gender. And Sarah, what about President Obama's call some months ago for a federal minimum wage hike to $10.10 an hour? It really seems a bit anemic here.
Yeah.
When workers are on the street demanding, and in a lot of cases now getting $15 an hour minimum wage in municipalities and such. What's the future of this federal minimum wage, and how important is it?
I mean, it's still very important. There's only a limited amount of places in this country where you can actually get a ballot initiative on a city or state level. A lot of places, the law precludes that. So we saw, for instance, when Scott Walker infamously took away collective bargaining rights from his public sector workers back in 2011, and his neighbor in Ohio did the same, the Ohio workers were able to get the issue on the ballot and overturn the issue, whereas Wisconsin law didn't allow for that. So we really see in cases like that the importance of being able to push policies in a myriad of different ways, certainly the national level. When you think about a state like Texas, the chances of the current governor of Texas, who has just been elected to his first term, and his state legislature passing a statewide minimum wage increase, which Texas, I believe, has the highest concentration of low-wage workers in the country. So we really do need to figure out ways to do this on a national level. Workers also manage to do these things in their workplace. So you mentioned union campaigns. What I think is really interesting about the movements that we're seeing right now is that they're not so much going workplace by workplace, fighting through a National Labor Relations Board election. That process has gotten so just incredibly impossible in recent years that we're really seeing these kind of pressure campaigns from the outside have much more success.
Sarah Jaffe, SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, has bankrolled a lot of the organizing that's been successful in mobilizing low-wage workers around the country. You've also had the United Food and Commercial Workers backing Walmart workers and such, and some workers' associations, not unions, but they've gotten some static from Walmart recently. But What can you tell us about the overall objectives of SEIU and the United Food and Commercial Workers when it comes to organizing these low-wage workers? There's a conventional wisdom that low-wage workers are very difficult to organize and stay on the job. And I'm wondering if you think this is a good strategy for the labor unions, or are we going to see their support fall away at some point?
I mean, I don't think it's that low-wage workers are difficult to organize. I think it is that at this point it is nearly impossible to win an NLRB election. And once you win an election against overwhelming odds, it is really nearly impossible to win a contract. And so what we're seeing from these unions that are willing to put some money into this is an awareness that we need a new model, that the one that we had for, you know, since 1935 is gone. It doesn't work fundamentally anymore. For it's certainly not going to work to organize new sectors. And so, you know, I think one of the best things about these two campaigns is that these unions have put money into it without a clear path to how this turns into dues-paying members for us. The fact that they've realized that they need to do something different, they need to come up with some creative ways to get workers in motion, I think that's the most hopeful thing I've seen out of the labor movement in a long time. And there's a growing awareness that that's the case, that we're seeing labor in a lot of places, either working with community groups, working with worker centers, really thinking about other ways to pressure employers, to pressure the government to do something about these conditions.
There are some observers who look at the organizing among low-wage workers by these unions and say there's quite a bit at stake here, given the fact that labor in this country has hemorrhaged millions of members over recent decades. And, you know, if the trajectory continues on this path, you know, labor and its influence in this country will be, you know, a tattered page in history. So how do you think the current campaign by these labor unions, how does that intersect with the future viability of the U.S. labor movement?
You know, labor staked a lot in 2008 on electing a Democrat and a Democratic legislature in order to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, which we all know what happened to that. And so since that moment, there has been, I think, a growing awareness that, again, that we need a new model, that something is going to have to change. And labor law reform, basically anything getting through the current Congress and the one we're likely to have after the next round of elections is just, you know, it's ridiculous. I'm hoping that that means that the labor movement will put a little bit less money into donating to Democrats this time around and a little bit more into organizing around issues, whether that's organizing around issues to make them issues in the presidential election or hopefully organizing around issues to get workers moving and making demands on them in a way that both injects them into the political debate and also makes them viable issues on a local level and viable issues within the workplace.
Sarah Jaffe, we mentioned Seattle a little while ago, and SeaTac and Seattle City proper have gone to a $15 an hour minimum wage, the first in the country to do so. And the Socialist Alternative Party and their elected city council person, Kashama Sawant, have been very prominent in that fight. And I'm wondering if you think there's a model that we could look to in Seattle for guidance on how these campaigns for a living wage could be successful in other cities, or is Seattle so unique in its social and political makeup that it's really something that's a one-off and could only happen in that particular municipality?
I mean, I think the lesson of Kashama Sawant is that people like candidates who tell them the truth. People like candidates who aren't afraid of who they are. People like candidates who aren't trying to sort of triangulate both sides. They like somebody who comes out and says, yes, I'm a socialist. I want $15 an hour minimum wage. I want rent control. I want a millionaire's tax, and runs on that and is explicit about running on it. And she is quite popular. I was in Seattle recently, and it seems she is quite popular. Of course, the business community hates her. Which should not be surprising to anybody and should not be a turnoff to anybody who actually cares about these issues. And what happened there, it is in a lot of ways a very unique confluence of events. They had a very strong campaign going at SeaTac, which is the town where the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport is based, that they got on the ballot at the same time as the city council and the mayor in Seattle were up for election. They had an incumbent mayor and a challenger who were both sort of looking to out-progressive each other. So we ended up with the man who is now mayor, Ed Murray, endorsing $15 an hour as a way to differentiate himself from the incumbent, who he ended up beating. And so once that happened, you saw 15 become an issue. But I think, you know, Sharma was clearly the first politician in the country to seize it and make it a campaign platform. And I think we'll see a lot more people doing that in the future because it worked very well for her. And so, yeah, on the one hand, Seattle is very unique. On the other hand, many of the things that happened there are actually replicable. And I think the biggest lesson is that this is popular. People like it. People want to raise the minimum wage on a broad bipartisan level. And not everybody might want to bring it up to 15, but I am a optimist. At the end of the day, I think that this is a great moment for this stuff if politicians weren't so afraid of losing big donors that they were scared to do anything about it.
We're speaking with Sarah Jaffe. She's a staff writer at In These Times and a fellow at the Nation Institute, who writes on labor, social movements, gender, and many other issues. Sarah, how much are workers risking as they walk off the job and participate in these protests and marches and, you know, certainly doing some talking up of the low-wage workers movement at the workplace? You mentioned before there's been some retaliation by these big companies to particular locations. I'm sure that happens in a lot of places we're not aware of. But how much are workers risking by participating here? And is there, you know, is there some assurance that, you know, organizing is a safe kind of activity to participate in? Or is it possible we might see an escalation of retaliation that could result in a lot of workers getting scared off?
I mean, technically it's illegal to fire people for a strike or other concerted activity on the job. That doesn't stop anybody from doing it. That's why I think these movements have been smart about bringing in a lot of community support. They walk the workers who have walked off the job back in the next day with a bunch of, you know, prominent people in their community and say, if you fire this person, we'll be back, which has, in fact, resulted in some workers getting rehired when they had an impromptu rally in their store calling for the rehiring of somebody. But yeah, I mean, workers are risking a lot. Workers are risking a lot more than the people who just show up to a rally are. It's real. But, living on $7.25 an hour is also not a safe and comfortable way to live your life. What happens when people are desperate and have no better option is that they, you know, take more and more dramatic action. So, you know, I think we will likely see escalation. I think this move from Walmart, we'll find out what a judge thinks. But, you know, it's hard not to read it as escalation from Walmart. And we're going to have to see escalation from the worker side, too, in order to actually win this.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Before you go, I just have this one sort of overarching question, and that is there are many people in progressive movements around the country who look at this low-wage workers protest movement and hope that this might be the beginning of a certain class consciousness and alliance between, longtime progressive activists who may not be working class themselves, and that this could be the birth of a new and more powerful movement that could influence U.S. politics and our national debate more so than the left has succeeded at in recent years. There hasn't been a lot of success there, certainly in some cases. But I'm wondering, as you look at some of the workers who participate in these low wage strikes and marches and walking off the job, and they're carrying the banner of other movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, which I thought was quite inspiring. How much potential do you see there in the birth of a new, more effective, more sort of cross-class progressive movement in the U.S.?
I mean, we are the 99%, right? That was the reason that that line, that slogan from Occupy took off and resonated with so many people, is it was at some point, I mean, A, it was about class. B, it was about this is all of us. This is not, you know, middle class. This is not just the fast food workers. This is all of us. And I do see these things connecting. If you'll forgive me for making a plug, I'm writing a book about this right now. And I do see these things as connected. I was in St. Louis recently talking to Fight for 15 workers. They call it Show Me 15 in Missouri, who are a part of the Ferguson protests, who are very deeply involved in both struggles and who see them as intimately connected. They say you can't do one without the other. I think we're seeing a very exciting moment. Once again, I have to kind of keep saying this. I think we're in a moment with a lot of potential. That doesn't mean it's magically going to all work out great. It's going to be a lot of hard work, but I'm very hopeful.
That's great. Sarah, what's the working title of the book you're working on?
The working title at the moment is Necessary Trouble, and it should be out in 2016 from Nation Books.
That's great. We'll stay in touch and have you back, but certainly want to discuss the book when it's published. We'd love to have you back on that. So
great.
But great talking with you, Sarah. Thanks for the discussion here on labor, the low-wage workers movement, and maybe some interesting and inspiring things coming together in the coming months. They already have, but maybe bigger things are afoot. Sarah, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Sarah Jaffe, staff writer at In These Times and a fellow at the Nation Institute.